This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon. Hey, Rahul. We've noticed that it's been snowing in Los Angeles and cats are playing with dogs and, you know, plaintiff and defense lawyers are getting along. What's going on in the world?
I know. Exactly. You know,
it's ground zero out there in Los Angeles.
See, that's the thing. You just can't believe the news all the time. Actually, they were talking about the town I live in, La Cañada, and I've been getting text messages saying, I heard there's landslides in La Cañada from the weather, and there's none of that that I know of. Every home is fine, but it is beautiful here. I mean, there's snow on the mountains. Ben, I don't know if you're familiar with seeing snow outside, but it is really pretty.
Yeah, I mean, if you look outside my window, you can't see anything but snow. You can't even see out the window of my home because there's a 10-foot snowbank in front of it from where the plow guy plows up the snow.
That is amazing.
But it does make for some nice skiing, so we enjoy that. But, you know, I feel like with you, I don't know what to believe. Am I getting fake news? Am I getting real news? What's going on? But, you know, I don't think people tune into our show to get news. I hope they don't anyway. Or we'll get sued for defamation or by, you know, somebody. Of course, nobody who listens to our show is litigious, so that's a good thing.
Oh, man. So everything going good over there, though?
Oh, yeah.
When's your next trial?
We're super busy. We're on two trial lists that we're trying to get scheduled. One is supposed to go in June. It's a federal court case. And then we've got a state court malpractice trial, which we're really pushing to get tried. And can't seem to get a date, but it could be as early as next month or, you know, May, June timeframe. So we'll keep you posted. And if I win, I'll come back and talk about it. How about you? You got one coming right up, right?
I do. I'm starting on Monday. I was actually supposed to start yesterday, but then the court was engaged in trial, so he pushed us to Monday. And it's a solid go, so we're all ready. Witnesses are set up. I am really excited about going to trial and particularly going to trial on this case, so after I'm done, I look forward to talking to you guys about it.
This is the jiu-jitsu case?
This is the jiu-jitsu case.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing about that. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to talk about it. Today, we're lucky to have Matt Sharp with us. So, Matt, thank you so much for joining us. And for those that don't know him, they should. But he is a stalwart in the Nevada community. He's been really effective and collaborative in all sorts of things legislatively to make sure to affect change that way, and is a fantastic trial lawyer who's recently got a $215 million verdict, including punitive damages. So, Matt, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Hey, how are you guys?
Doing great. We've got all these trials set up. I know you're busy up there in Reno as well.
Yeah, I don't have as many trials as you have. You're like the person you're a trial every time I talk to you.
No, it's been interesting. So Matt, let's start at the beginning. Give us a little background on how and why you became a trial lawyer.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I was in college, I was probably not the student I should have been, kind of a little wayward. Decided my sophomore year it'd be a good idea to become a lawyer, and a friend of mine said, you'll never do it. So that kind of became like a, I'm going to do it. And then I had the benefit of having in my family a judge by the name of Judge Proctor R. Hugg Jr. He was a Ninth Circuit judge, chief judge, actually, which is, of course, a big deal for somebody from Reno, Nevada at the time. And he was kind of a role model in terms of what a lawyer should be like, what a judge should be like. That's what I want to do. Be somebody like him.
When you said in your family, you're saying you're related?
Yeah, my uncle, my mom's older brother, Proctor R. Hugg, and just an incredible human being. You know, it's like I think of judges, one of the things, you know, I think that we become cynical about as we become lawyers is we start meeting judges who they really are. And sometimes that doesn't fit with our reality of what it should be like. But the way my uncle was, I mean, it didn't matter who you were. He went to the same diner every day for lunch, treated everybody with respect. And I just, having grown up with that, I thought, geez, that's the kind of thing I would like to do as a lawyer. And he was a trial lawyer. And then during law school, you know, reading about stories, you know, like true trial lawyers making a difference, figured that's what I wanted to do.
So then how did you go about accomplishing that?
Well, I got into law school.
Congratulations.
I went to Arizona, which now they probably wouldn't have never accept me. But, you know, and then got through, got a job. You know, I always figured that I just kind of liked the idea of being somebody that was trying to make the difference. And when I went to work out of law school, it was the middle of the like 91, 92 recession. And in Southwest, I don't know if you guys may not remember, but at that time frame, it was right at the end of the savings and loan crisis. So Phoenix, Nevada, even Southern California were kind of, Northern California were kind of dead. So I just got a job with a guy who would give me a job. So, yeah, I'd been 3 or 4 months and I did a jury trial. It was a crappy case, but it was a jury trial. I mean, we lost, but my boss was willing to let me go to do a trial after 3 or 4 months and then, you know, started doing, he didn't like going to trial, so he let me do it.
What was the case?
It was, I mean, you know, probably in retrospect, it may have not been that bad, but it was an experience. But it was a little baby was sitting with her mother on a window seat, and the mother, like, kind of like, you know, got out of control and pushed against a screen and fell out of the screen, just popped out, and he fell down, and, you know, 2 stories and struck his head. And the idea was that the screen was defective. And I probably, in retrospect, probably wasn't a bad case, but I just didn't, you know, have the experience. And I just remember hiring an expert that was just, he was horrible. But, you know, we've all had
I think we've all had that experience.
So anyway, that's how I got into doing trial practice, losing.
So, Just thinking about that for a moment, coming off a loss your first time in trial, how did you feel about trying cases, confidence, comfort level, and did the losing have an impact on sort of your desire to be a trial lawyer?
I guess it did because I wanted to win. And I think the learning experience I had out of that was, you know, I was against experienced defense lawyers in the Reno area, and I realized that they weren't all that much better than I was, and they weren't any better, and, you know, they weren't any more comfortable in front of a jury than I was. And so I kind of, you know, in a weird way, they gave me some confidence. And, you know, I remember I had another trial, like, within that same time period, it was a bench trial from an old kind of like an infamous judge. He was a good judge, but he was very strict. And we won that case. You know, like literally the findings of fact and conclusions of law were verbatim to what I proposed. And we represented a black church who had bought a property from the Protestants, I think. And then certainly, so then the Protestants backed out of the deal because they found a white church that would take the same property. And we ended up filing a lawsuit to enforce the sale. So, you know, it kind of makes you feel good. And so then from there, just kept trying. I mean, that's kind of what you have to do, right?
Yeah. So as you started trying cases and getting more years under your belt, were there any mentors that you had that kind of took you under your wing?
Yeah. You know, I've been lucky. I've had different mentors in my career. I mean, certainly one of them has been Rick Friedman. I got to know Rick from a mutual friend of ours who lives in Reno and is kind of was like a insurance expert. His name is Gary Fye. And at that time, Rick was kind of like the guy for insurance bad faith. And Gary started having these seminars. It was essentially Rick teaching what's now the rules of the road. So through that connection, I did a couple cases with those guys. And so I think Rick is certainly one of many. Another local lawyer here in town, Bill Genet. I mean, you guys know Bill Bradley. You may know Bill Genet too. Bill Bradley's partner, longtime partner, is Bill Genet. And he was helpful, like just a guy that tried cases and you could go to and talk about what do I do here. So I think, you know, and certainly my first boss, Gene Leverty, he let me try cases when most people wouldn't. So you got to respect that.
Just kind of picking them off the list, Rick Friedman, Bill Bradley, and others. What were some of the things that they taught you that you implement in your practice and trial practice?
Well, I think, I mean, you got to say that in many ways, whatever Rick Friedman tells you is probably, it's like Brian Panish. If Brian Panish or Rick Friedman tell you to do something, it works, you know, and you got to listen. So I think that, you know, I remember I lost a case against State Farm back in the day when State Farm was using phony IME reports to deny claims. And I remember talking to Rick after I lost that case. I was young. And he's like, I've lost cases before. And I was like, Rick Friedman, you've lost cases? You know what I mean? It's like somebody at that stature tells you like, hey, I've been there. It sucks, but keep going. I mean, that makes a big difference, I think.
Do you do a lot of insurance bad faith or insurance type cases?
Yeah, that's kind of been my specialty, insurance bad faith. And, you know, I've gotten into some complicated, you know, PI cases, but I'm in a lot of ways just been pigeonholed into being a bad faith lawyer.
It's interesting how you say that. You got to be careful about the phraseology of it, but I think that's we understand what you mean by that.
People assume that's all you do, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. I don't want to bore anyone to death, but can you give us like the primer on bad faith?
So I
say this because we recently got an overage verdict and we're exploring bad faith claims. And in our state, my home state, there's very little jurisprudence on bad faith. So we've started to sort of canvass the national scene and notice that there's a lot of differences jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but seems like there's some maybe general principles that apply across the board. And I just think it would be helpful for our listeners to have an understanding of what to look for and maybe how to set up the bad faith claim from the outset.
Yeah.
So doing the right thing.
So I would begin by saying there's two types of bad faith, a first party claim and a third party claim. The third party claim is your liability claim where the person you're suing is the insured. And that's where we hear the concepts of, you know, duty to defend, duty to settle. And so in that context, it's basically three primary issues in a what we call third party setting. And at first is, did they defend the case? You have two basic benefits under your liability insurance policy, defense and indemnification. So did they defend the case? Secondly, you have a duty to indemnify, which includes within the duty to defend is a duty to settle when liability is reasonably clear. So did they have the information to settle the case, and were they given the opportunity? And if they weren't, if they were and they failed to settle when liability has been reasonably clear, you got a pretty good failure to settle case, which is the one that allows you to uncap the policy, so to speak. So those are the two basic things with liability: defense, indemnification. Did they?
You're still talking about third party now?
Yeah.
And how many states recognize third party bad faith claims? Because I don't, you know, my home state does not, I believe.
And if they, and it is Maine Supreme Court ruled that it's not a cause of, you know, that there's no cause of action for the duty of good faith and fair dealing.
There is in a first party sense, but not in a third party sense.
Wow. That's weird. A lot of states, it's reversed.
Like you can get the claim assigned to you from the insured and pursue it in that fashion.
Okay.
But you can't directly pursue that as... There's no duty to the third party directly.
Yeah, yeah. So let me be clear about that, because that's right. That's probably, I'm using language because I'm immersed in the practice. When I say third party bad faith, I don't mean the plaintiff in the underlying action has a direct claim against the insurance company. I don't know. I mean, California used to have that case. Kentucky has that claim. No, I don't know of any other state besides Kentucky you can do that. When I say third-party liability, bad faith, I mean the insured is the defendant in the tort lawsuit. And so then the question becomes, how do you determine whether there's bad faith on a failure to settle case? You know, you get a big verdict on in our state, minimum policy is 25-50. So, like, you know, big case, they don't settle for the 25. One, is there bad faith? Did they give the opportunity to settle? Was liability reasonably clear? You know, those questions need to be answered. Then once you have that, then you have to figure out, how do you get the defendant to bring that case? Because both in Nevada and, I mean, in California particularly, Nevada's never directly addressed this, but I think they would follow California, is the punitive damage claim belongs to the insured. It can't be assigned. So typically you have this situation, like you get a big verdict, let's say you get $1 million verdict on the 25-50 policy. Now, some people would say, I'm just going to go to that to the defendant and get an assignment of rights, and then I can pursue the claim for $1 million. Better approach, in my opinion, is to figure out a way to get the defendant to bring that case. And, you know, there's different things you can do. For example, in other cases, we have said we've gotten involved representing the defendant post-trial, and we enter into a settlement agreement with the plaintiff, which requires the defendant to file a bad faith lawsuit, and then you allocate the proceeds from that lawsuit. The benefit to that is it keeps your punitive damage claim. The downside to that is, you know, you don't always control the defendant, and that's not always available, or the defendant's not somebody that's very empathetic. But ideally, you always want to bring the bad faith case on behalf of the insured, because it's just cleaner. Does that make sense? I mean, I didn't mean to like suggest.
That does make sense. And does part of your arrangement with the insured or the defendant in the original case, does it include an agreement not to execute against them? And if it does have that in it, does that, and could that risk destroying your bad faith claim because now they no longer have exposure?
Well, the first answer is yes, you do give a covenant not to execute. The second answer is no, it shouldn't. So ideally, if you have a defendant who's represented by independent counsel, somebody who's not the defense lawyer, you have a defense lawyer who's paying attention to their responsibility, that, you know, the primary client is the defendant. If you have access to that defendant and you can set up a settlement, let's say Rahul's client gets a $1 million verdict on the 2550 policy. I get contacted to represent the defendant as independent counsel. I would go to Rahul and say, look, we got this great bad faith case. We're willing to pursue that bad faith case in exchange for a covenant not to execute. Rahul says, well, what? I mean, how do I know you're going to pursue that claim? So I then give, you know, a covenant that if I don't pursue that claim, I'm on the hook for the judgment. So you make it so ultimately the insured's still responsible for payment. And the only way they're going to get paid is through the lawsuit against the insurance company. So you got to be kind of careful because you don't want to be in a position where the defense is, hey, Rahul and I colluded to create this bad faith case. And that inevitably is always, the defense always tries to make that run. So you just got to, I mean, it's all on the up and up. I mean, it's simple enough, but it's conceptually, it's something outside the box if you don't do bad faith cases.
This is where, you know, maybe we're starting to bore people. I hope not, though, because some people will have these cases and need to understand them. But does it matter whether the defendant has assets or whether they're judgment proof or whether they're, you know, they're at risk for the amount of the verdict, or they could just file bankruptcy and avoid it?
In terms of like being a legal claim, no, it doesn't. But obviously, it's like any case, if you're representing the widow who's got her retirement account that now is subject potentially to Rahul attaching on it, that's going to be a better case than somebody who's got no assets and never had the obligation, you know, was never going to pay it anyway. But the law of bad faith is the insurance company can't say, hey, you know, you don't have any money, so we can, you know, we don't have to defend you. We don't have to settle the case because, you know, we get a free pass. That's not the case. So the law of bad faith is if you fail in either your duty to defend or your duty to settle, the automatic result is you're responsible for the judgment, period. So it's kind of like, I don't really want to call it a penalty, but it's in a way, it's like a consequential damage that we learned in law school, right? I mean, it's the same concept.
Can you give us some examples of the kind of conduct that would be sufficient to establish bad faith? Because I understand it's more than, in most states, it has to be more than negligence, right?
Yeah. Okay. So that gets a little complicated. First question you have to ask is, was the duty to defend breached or the duty to settle? And some states intertwine the two. Like in Nevada, the duty to defend includes the duty to settle. And that's not necessarily the case in California, as an example. So if you have a duty to defend case, it's simply, did the allegations in the complaint arise to a level of potential for coverage? If it did, you win.
Right.
And so the level of proof is much less, right? Duty to settle is they've got to have a reasonable opportunity, or I always say liability is reasonably clear. And doesn't mean absolute. Liability is reasonably clear and the damages reasonably exceed the policy limit. If those two things exist, you've got a good bad faith case. Now, the next step really is the punitive damage function, which is what you're talking about. And I'm talking just third-party cases. First-party are different. Third-party case, you know, we go through that mantra. Was it defense breach or was there duty to settle breach? Then you're looking for the punitive damage element. And obviously in that context, in Nevada, it's conscious disregard for the rights of the insured. You know, it's a higher level of proof for sure. And so like one of the things I look at is simplicity of liabilities first. Is the liability a good liability theory? Then what are the injuries? Obviously, you want to know that how injured was the insured. And then looking at the evaluation by the insurance company. So I'm thinking like right now of a case that we had that we did for Sean Claggett on a case he had an excess verdict in Las Vegas. and it was a brain injury case. And the insurance company hired a radiologist who confirmed that there was a brain injury. And then they 86'd that expert for obvious reasons, but they disregarded what the expert said. And then they hired a neuropsychologist who acknowledged that there were ongoing problems that this plaintiff had, and they didn't consider that aspect. They did their own focus groups, and their own focus groups indicated that the case value was anywhere from 20 to 40 million. They made no effort to settle. So those kinds of things, like, that's a conscious, deliberate thought versus, hey, we made a judgment call and we rolled, you know, and who knows what a jury's going to do, that kind of thing, you know. So I look at it kind of backing up and say, okay, how did we get here? And what's the root cause of why we got here? And usually that root cause is somebody in the process didn't value that case with the equal consideration interest, you know, considering their insurer's interest equal to that of the insurance company. Usually, you know, and there are always exceptions, but, and it, I think the big issue that I've seen were cases that could be good that I don't get involved in is giving the insurance company the opportunity to settle. Okay. I've always said in bad faith litigation, I don't care what kind of case it is. There's always, the defense is always, there's a setup. The lawyer representing the claimant, representing the insured, tried to screw us. You know, it's a weird concept, right? But you got to recognize that. So what I always tell people is, look, the insurance companies, you don't set them up. They hang themselves. And you've got to give that opportunity. So if you make a policy limit demand, let's say you make a policy limit demand, you give them 30 days. And they contact you and say, you know, we need three more days to just, I got to go to my supervisor to get approval for this, but I just need 3 days. And the attorney says, no, I'm not going to do that. Well, I mean, it's not a very good bad faith case. You've got to give them a little, you have to allow them to eliminate the defense of corporate bureaucracy or stupidity. You just have to let them trip themselves up. Or, like, people that make demands, you know, here's it's $100,000. Let's say it's $100,000 policy. Here's the medical bill of $110,000. We want to settle within 10 days. I mean, you know, you can't expect the insurance company to verify damages without medical records. That's an example. Okay, so I think that what I look at in a large part is the conduct of the lawyer. Did he or she give them the opportunity to settle? And were they reasonable in how they approached it? The answer is yes, and usually you got a pretty good case.
What if you have an insurance defense lawyer that papers his or her file to the carrier saying, you know, we could win or we could lose, but I think there's a decent chance at a defense verdict. And that's just the mantra going through the defense attorney's communications to the carrier. But from the outside, looking at it, it appears to be that the lawyer's protecting the carrier at the expense of their actual client, defendant in the case.
And I think you see that more and more. I mean, it used to be when I first started practicing, you would have the defense lawyer writing the letter saying this case needs to settle, and then they disregard it, you know, and that's obviously pretty bad. But I think as the market has become more competitive for defense work, the defense lawyers, whether consciously or subconsciously, they try to protect themselves. So in that context you're talking about, Raul, I would be looking at, one, the duty to evaluate a claim is non-delegable. I mean, so you can rely upon your lawyer, consider that information, but it's not exclusive. And if you have a lawyer who's bragging about, I can defense this case, and you have a court of liability with a serious injury, that insurance company's got to say, well, okay, that's great, but we're the ones that were writing the check. We're the ones with the responsibility to the insured. What are we doing? And so what I have found over the course of about the last 10 years is these insurance adjusters are not trained to value claims. They really aren't. You know, I took a deposition about a year ago of a State Farm adjuster who'd been an adjuster like 15 years. She'd never been in a courtroom. I mean, think about that. Never been in a courtroom. How can you evaluate the dynamics of a jury trial when you've never seen one? And so the cause there then is these people aren't trained. And so what I focus upon is, you know, it's the top down. Like in a bad faith case, you build the case from the top down. You have an event. It's kind of like, I think it's like Rodney Jew says, you have your bubble and you're trying to explain the root cause of that bubble. And that's really bad faith because the defense job is to break it down from the bottom up. They just take out a pillar. And what we're trying to show is, hey, this is a corporate mentality to hold that money, to take a roll of the dice at their insurer's expense. And when something goes bad, we're going to say, well, the lawyer told us it was we could go to trial. Well, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of what I looked at.
Along those lines, what are you able to get in discovery and what is shielded by attorney-client privilege or doctrines that don't permit you to discover it?
So proportionality is a big one, and particularly in federal court, I think that, state courts here are pretty bad about proportionality. In the third-party liability case, there is no attorney-client privilege because the attorney represents the insured and the insurance company under joint representation theory, with the insured being the primary client. There is a defense called advice of counsel. So like say you have a coverage issue and the insurance company sends the issue out for a coverage opinion. If the insurance company asserts advice of counsel, they've waived the privilege implicitly or explicitly. So it's kind of the same concept. I mean, I think most jurisdictions have the concept of the sword and the shield. Can't use the privilege as a sword and a shield. So we get into that a lot, and more so over the last 10 years. And then the other one is, again, you know, identifying the case. Some cases lend themselves to a corporate liability approach. So you're looking for employment evaluations, corporate goals. Like one case we had, there was a corporate goal to increase profits by like 20%. Well, you can't, it's a conflict. The person who's responsible for writing the check for the benefit of the insured can't have the conflicting motive of expanding their salary or meeting corporate goals by paying less. It's a conflict. So some of those cases lend to that. And in those situations, you get into a lot of discovery fights over relevance, proportionality, that sort of stuff. And I mean, the argument is, hey, you know, it's a corporate tort. We need to know what the corporate mindset was in order to find out what the root cause of the denial was.
When you've got a case where there's a lot of disputed facts regarding, let's say, whether there was bad faith in the settlement decisions, at what point does that get to the jury? And at what point does the judge can the judge take that away from you on motions?
So that's a good question, because in bad faith, I think more so than any other cases I've been involved in, they are summary judgment driven. I can't remember a bad faith case I've had in my career where the defense didn't move for summary judgment on coverage and punitive damages. I mean, most of us, when we have a punitive damage case, you're used to having that motion on punitive damages filed. But in bad faith, every case. So one of the things that I do is I kind of build a a list of facts of what is it that this insurance company did that I can prove they knowingly or unreasonably denied a claim with conscious disregard. So then you come back to insurance litigation is very rule oriented. there are specific rules insurance companies have to follow. And getting them to agree to those in deposition and then demonstrating the violation. So, for example, let's take a case where, let's say you have a case where the basis for denying, the basis for not settling the case is we had a defense medical exam done. And the defense medical exam said there's no causation. I mean, those can be tough cases. We're not doctors. This doctor said it was okay. So then the question is, well, what did you know about this doctor? And what was it about this doctor that led you to believe that that doctor is going to be more persuasive than the plaintiff's treating physician? And, you know, we know in practicing that we run against these same doctors over and over again. Well, the insurance companies know that. So I try and build in bias with the expert, for example. Can't rely upon a biased expert against the interests of your insured. So that's one example. And we might, in a case, depending on the value, maybe we would say, okay, we want to get all of the reviews that you had this doctor do over the past 5 years and maybe be able to establish a pattern that each review basically looks the same or each review was always defense-oriented. Sometimes reviews themselves are so outrageous. Like, how could somebody objectively rely upon some of these doctors? Particularly, I don't know what it's like in Raul in LA or in California, but it just seems to me like in Las Vegas, as an example, the reviewers are just so overtly biased. I mean, you don't even really need to do any discovery. It's just, you take the report and it's so biased, you just go through with the adjuster. Why would you rely upon this? So that, you know, that's an example. Just remember, everything in insurance brings back to a core issue is the insurance company always has to consider its interest equal to that of its insured. So they always have to do a balancing test. They can't just blindly follow the facts they want to follow.
So one more question on this that I have and wanted to get your thoughts on this. Let's just say you have a case, and I'll pick a random hypothetical. You've got a $100,000 insurance policy, catastrophic injuries to the plaintiff, something like in the, you know, mid seven figures, eight figures types of damages. And it's an auto crash, who ran the red light type of case.
Mm-hmm.
Then policy limit demand is made by the plaintiff through their counsel to the insurance company and says, hey, bad crash, it's your insured's fault. Damages are here. Here's all the medical records and the medical bills, and you should pay it. And they give them reasonable time to pay it, 30 days, 45 days, whatever you want to say. And then they don't pay it. And then the plaintiff's counsel takes the deposition of the defendant, and the defendant goes, I ran the red light. Okay. And then what happens next? So then do you have to go through a full trial? The insured maybe gets QMIS counsel at this point, who's saying, I don't know why the insurance company didn't pay. This thing should have settled for the $100,000 policy, and now my client's screwed. Can we stipulate to a judgment? Can we do something like that? How does that work, or can that not work in order to pursue bad faith rights later?
So the first
thing, one more thing to Raul's fact that you could address. So after the deposition of the defendant, then the insurance company says, we're prepared now to tender the policy. And you say,
sure,
we're not interested in that anymore. The policy's opened. You've declined. Add that one little extra detail in to your
answer. Sure. I was going to say implied within that is there after that happens.
I thought that was implied, but.
Yeah.
So that's like a pretext for figuring out why we disregard the insured's rights in the first place. So the first thing you got to do is you got to do the research. In California, as long as the insurance company is defending the insured is obligated to go through the trial. That's pretty clear law. They're obligated. And then in California, then the question is, once the judgment's entered, is the insured obligated to continue forward with the appeal? I would say, no, they're not. Defense lawyers would say they are. But there's some case law. We won't get into nuances, but that's just that's in California. Other states, like Arizona, when the breach occurs, the insured has the right to protect their interest and enter into a non-collusive stipulated judgment. The Arizona rule is supported by the Restatement Third. Restatement Third provisions say that if the insurance company made an unreasonable settlement decision, the insured is freed from their duty to cooperate and has the right to enter into a collusive, non-collusive settlement with the insured. The majority rule, I believe, follows the restatement. But most states, like Nevada included, have not decided this issue. So like in Nevada, that's a question we have to have when we take a look at a case like that. Do we say, let's go through the trial? Ideally, yes. But that's something, you know, we don't live in an ideal world. And sometimes we just have to say, okay, let's do a non-collusive settlement agreement. You know, you can stipulate, like we've had instances where you take the case value to a mediator, have an arm's length negotiation, or take it to, you know, binding arbitration on valuation. But some way that you can objectively say, this is how we came up with the figure. And then you get that assignment or you enter into a settlement agreement that the insured has to pursue the claim. That's how you do it. I don't think it matters. So the insurance companies are, in terms of your question, Ben, now go back to the after all this happens, they offer the policy limit. Does that like cure the bad faith effectively? And the answer is no. You got to take the decision at the time it was made. Was it reasonable? They can't then come back and say, well, now I know blah, blah, blah. So I'm going to pay. Well, why wouldn't they know that they're insured admitted liability? I mean, that's part of their investigation. They should have known that up front. They probably did.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
Okay, so Ben, I think it's fair to say that Matt knows what he's talking about when it comes to this bad faith stuff, right?
My takeaway from all this is I need to talk to you about my bad faith case, and if anybody else has one, they should call Matt and ask him to help or send him the case.
So this kind of laid the perfect groundwork for it comes as no surprise that you got a $215 million verdict recently in an insurance bad faith case. So tell the listeners a little bit about that case. I know we were texting while you were in trial on that and
yeah. I was
amazed by it.
So it was the verdict is $200 million with post-judgment interest. It's about $215 plus right now. So it was a first party bad faith case. We haven't talked about that concept. First party bad faith case is you file the claim with your insured health insurance, first party bad faith, homeowners insurance, first party bad faith. So it was a health insurance case, individual health insurance case, where our client purchased a policy that provided major medical insurance coverage. Before the policy was purchased, his now widow studied the market, contacted the insurance company and said, hey, my husband has stage 4 lung cancer. We want to go to MD Anderson to be evaluated for treatment, including a therapy called proton beam radiation. And is it covered? Agent gives her an insurance policy. The insurance policy says radiation therapy is covered with no exclusions. So then the family goes to MD Anderson. They see the best of the best in terms of radiation oncologists who recommend a type of therapy called proton beam therapy. Basically, the difference is any radiation will kill cancer. The problem with radiation is everything else it kills. So the proton, the theory behind proton is it allows for a more finite distribution of the radiation to avoid damage to adjacent organs. And Bill Eskew had a tumor right next to his esophagus and right near his heart. So he qualified for proton beam therapy. Claim was filed for pre-authorization, and unbeknownst to the family, United Healthcare, Sierra Health and Life was the defendant, subsidiary of United Healthcare, had created a corporate policy to automatically deny any claim involving proton beam therapy without investigation, without consideration of the insurance contract. It was automatically denied. It had a whole procedure, I won't get into the details, but it was a corporate procedure to deny claims based upon what they called a corporate medical policy. And that corporate medical policy was, we said, hidden from the insured, not part of the contract. That was undisputed. It wasn't part of the contract. And that formed the basis for the denial. But to exercise the denial, under Nevada law, you have to have a doctor sign off on the denial. So they hired a stooge, oncologist at $200 an hour to rubber stamp denials. So literally, we figured a trial that this guy spent no more than 12 minutes denying this man's claim, which was intended to be curative, but certainly was going to benefit this man's life. And so claim was denied. The radiation oncologist testified at trial. She said, when I found out it was United Healthcare, I told the family, this is the worst. They never changed their mind. I can contact the doctors, but they'll never listen to me. And you can fight this, but who's to say in 2-3 weeks, I can do anything. And you have a tumor right next to your esophagus, right next to your throat. I need to do something. So I'm good at what I do. I recommend this alternative treatment. It's not what I would want to do. There's heightened risk, but we got to do something. So he went through the, it's called IMRT. He went through the IMRT, Bill did, and it has excoriated his esophagus, which everyone knew that was a risk. It was like demonstrated in the studies that MD Anderson had done, the own studies that the insurance company cited to in their corporate policy specified that if you, that the risk of damage to grade, what they call grade 3 or grade 4 esophagitis was many times more likely if you use IMRT versus proton beam therapy. And they just didn't care because it was money. And so Bill went through this, excoriated his esophagus, nearly died, lost about 20% of his body weight in a 6-week period, miraculously fought back and kind of plateaued. But if you think, you know, it's funny because when we get involved as personal injury lawyers, you know, there's not like a body part that we don't think about until you think about the case you had this in. So what happens with the esophagus is when it's damaged, it's like a nasty sunburn. That's how our expert talked about it. And so like it's basically a burn. And when a burn heals, what happens? It develops scar tissue. And so what happened to Bill is the esophagus healed. It developed scar tissue throughout his esophagus. And he couldn't swallow. He constantly felt like things were stuck in his throat. So family said that he would have a puke bucket next to him. That's what they called it. And just, I mean, destroyed what remaining life this man had. And it was horrible. So, and it was part of a corporate policy. They were unapologetic. They went to trial claiming, well, nobody reputable uses proton beam therapy. It's a scam. It's a scam on the insurance industry. Well, the scam is paid for by Medicare. Medicare recognizes this therapy. The TRICARE recognizes it. FDA recognizes it. It's many major cancer institutions recognize this therapy. But the crowning thing was, is the sister company of United Healthcare, who owns both the medical end and the insurance end of the companies, had ventured anywhere between $15 to $50 million in operating their own proton beam therapy center in New York City. So if you went to New York City to their proton beam therapy, they would treat you with proton beam therapy for lung cancer. So it's just this massive, like, it's just a horrible, horrible corporate behavior.
Can I ask about, I mean, that really is an incredible story and seems like such a righteous case. In fact, it reminds me of that Matt Damon movie, I think, where the insurance company denied the claims. It's very similar in certain ways.
In The Rainmaker, they had a thing about the appeal. I don't know if you remember that, but they had an appeal was like automatically denied. So in our case, we didn't file the appeal. So the defense became the appeal should have been filed. And which is
what I was going to ask you about. What about exhausting these remedies, and what do you have to worry about if you're looking at doing a case like this regarding a denial of an important medical a drug or a procedure? Because we see that quite a bit. Actually, we do a lot of malpractice cases, and that can be an issue. So what do you have to worry about in terms of exhausting internal remedies or appeals before you can bring that insurance case?
So you've got a difference. Of course, if you've got an ERISA policy, employer provided, you have to follow the appeal process. You have no bad faith claim, but in order to preserve whatever ERISA claim, you have to follow the appeal process. And the appeal process is essentially when the case is litigated. So if you have a client who has a serious medical condition denied, the appeal is basically the key aspect. And most providers don't understand that. So by the time you talk to somebody who's got an ERISA case, the appeal's already been filed, and the doctor, you know, they're not lawyers, so they do their best, but they're not persuasive enough to win. In an individual health insurance case, you look at the insurance policy. Is an appeal required? In our case, it was not required. Then the question is, either way, they're going to build this in a defense. And so in our case, it made a big deal about the appeal. The doctor didn't believe in the therapy, and because had she believed in the therapy, she would have filed an appeal. And so we ended up in the defense case, they brought an economist out to talk about how great insurance companies were. And so he had put in his report, like, he had some statistic, like less than 1% of any claim that's appealed prevails. Like most claims are not appealed. And then those that are appealed, it's like less than 1%. I don't remember exactly the stat, but it was horrible, are actually overturned. So it's a total sham. And what we did in our case, it's like you don't get a free denial. That's what our expert talked about. It's like you don't get a free denial. You got to do your job up front. And their expert on cross, I asked him, I go, what does this appeal have anything to do with anything while we're here? And I said, you would agree that if the jury finds that this claim was wrongfully denied, the appeal is meaningless. It's irrelevant. And he said, yeah, I agree with that. So the point that I would make so what happens is,
of course, it seems obvious in your case they would have denied the appeal since they claimed it was a sham. A procedure anyway. Why would they move that on appeal?
I can't think of any appeal, any case that's brought to me where they change their mind on appeal. I can't think of maybe one case in my entire career. And that's when we handled the appeal. What happens is in a medical industry is you'll file the appeal, they'll send it out to a third party reviewer who's controlled by the insurance industry. You know, they're not objective. It's just like it's the same thing as we see in our tort cases. And they find somebody who just rubber stamps a denial. Then these state entities have created review boards, they call them. And they were created with great intent, being fair and finding doctors that actually knew what they were doing. But those things are all run by the insurance industry. So it's basically the whole thing's a sham process. And that was what was so beautiful about this economist from Harvard, is he had the stats to prove it. Like, he had like 1% of any claim actually appealed is overturned. I mean, that's remarkable. In the Eskew case, we never got their appeal stats for a number of reasons, but that's what we wanted to see. Like, how often do these things ever result in anybody being overturned? I don't think the insurance companies want to show that, because these appeals are a sham, and it's probably related to ERISA because they get a lot of protections under ERISA.
Are you doing ERISA cases too?
Not really. I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, I'll do an ERISA long-term disability policy that's got a lot of big policy. It's just so hard to win these cases. And, you know, like in health insurance, you get calls because obviously people don't know the difference. They call because they need help. And it's incredible because in health insurance, let me just tell you what happens. Bill Eskew would have had no claim under ERISA because he didn't pay for the procedure. They paid the claim. They paid for the alternative therapy. So he would be locked out of the federal court system. But say, let's say you pay that. You pay $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $100,000. It varies between the markets. So you pay out $100,000 to get proton beam therapy. You file a lawsuit, the most you get is $100,000. Maybe attorney's fees if you can prove bad faith. The cases are litigated at the appeal stage. So if the policy contains an arbitrary and capriciousness clause, which basically says the insurance company has the discretion to read its policy. If it contains that provision, you have to prove the insurance company not only wrongfully denied the claim, but it was arbitrary and capricious. And the only evidence you can use is the evidence that existed at the time the claims were denied. And so the burden is so hard. And who's going to have the money to pay a lawyer to do that? And in health insurance, you don't get a judgment. The court orders the plan to pay the bill. So it's just everything is stacked against an insured in that. It's just horrible law, which is probably why we see a lot of it.
What was it like when that verdict came back? That must have been an incredible moment.
Oh, it was great. It was great. Yeah, it was amazing because what happened was, it's funny because I'll tell this story. Raul had an esophagitis case at the same time I was doing mine, and his was pretty serious injury. And so I call him. I said, "Well, I'm gonna ask for $30 million." He says, "What are your specials?" I said, "I haven't no specials, no specials. 12 months of suffering." And we felt like that. This case was so powerful, and the message it had to be, you know, the suffering was so incredible that it justified that. And so when the case came back, the jury was only out for 45 minutes. And so that's usually not a good sign for us, or at least that's the myth maybe. And so when it came back and the jury was unanimous, and I've never had a jury. Usually, so in bad faith cases, any punitive damage case in Nevada, you have a bifurcated proceeding. So the first step is you decide if there's fraud, malice, or oppression for punitive damages. And then next phase is punitive damages. So usually when you get a punitive damage verdict, there's a little bit of like the jurors going, I got to come back. Even in the back, you know, it's just like they think they're done. Like we filled everything out. Now we got to come back. Not this jury. It was like the judge is like, everybody ready for tomorrow? Yes, Your Honor. I mean, they saw the importance of this case.
And what were the compensatories and what were the punitives?
Compensatories were $40 million. The punitive damages were $160 million. Ratio.
You asked for 30 and they gave you 40?
Yeah. Well, I ranged it. I said at least 30. You can go higher. I probably should have been. I wasn't as clear. The record's not clear as I remembered it. But
you said at least three times with it, whatever they give Rahul.
Yeah, exactly.
And it became like a thing in the trial. Funny part of the trial was when we were in Fort Dyer, and I was asking, I started out by asking, you know, look, the questions of, is anybody having something in their minds they can't award beyond, you know, that frame of questioning. And I said, well, just for example, if we asked for $15 million for pain and suffering, you don't know anything about the case. And I was intending to go up from there, you know. And one of these jurors, who was like the meanest, like, he's an evil SOB, and he couldn't hear very well. And so he goes, that's outrageous. And he goes off and on, you know, how can anybody get that? $50 million is insane. And I go, well, thank you, sir. But I said 15. And he said, oh, 15 I can do. So it kind of blew my full cash challenge. Challenge it for cause. He said he'd give me 15. That's what you asked for.
That's an illustration of anchoring in a very
visceral
way.
So the trial then became like this thing, like, what were we going to ask for between 15 to 50? That became what we were going to talk about. And the defense even adopted it. Of course, for other reasons, they thought we were being greedy. But it's like everybody in the court, like all of a sudden, it didn't seem like very much money.
Well, that's an amazing result. And hopefully it will teach United Health the lesson, but I'm sure it won't.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we get good case law out of this for people. I mean, it's the first, you know, so much of their procedures are ERISA-based. They're never taken to task. And it's really what they have done and the health insurance industry in part, but United Healthcare is the leader of the health insurance industry, is they have adopted systems that are in violation of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, and they don't care. Like, they just don't care. They didn't even train
because they're normally used to getting the ERISA protection, so their systems are based on that. And then when they have a directly sold policy, they just are still implementing the same systems, assuming ERISA protections apply, and they don't. Is that kind of why they're doing it that way?
I think that they haven't been held to account because of ERISA. But I think that what we see is the systematic corporatization of misconduct. I mean, it's no different than what we see, you know, what you see in your medical cases, like in a hospital that doesn't staff nurses properly or something like that. We see now the torts are based upon systemic misconduct. So the thing that United Healthcare did by creating this system where you use a corporate policy to automatically deny claims, they eliminated any form of personal accountability, and they eliminated any form of humanity. So like the people denying the claim, they denied the claim, but they didn't think they were doing anything wrong because they were following the procedures. And if they had to think about why they followed the procedures, then they got to think about Bill Eskew and other Bill Eskews of the world. And you can't do that because then you bring humanity into the system. And the people at the top who created the corporate policies, they said, well, we never intended these corporate policies to be the only reason people deny claims. So they have no accountability. You know, these are guidelines. And so if you create a system where nobody's accountable, but the bottom line's increasing, I mean, I think that's what you get. And I think you see that in a lot of corporate cases now. At least that's my experience, you know, in the bigger cases.
Yeah, I agree. It's sort of when everybody's responsible, nobody's responsible. And that's how they set up the system intentionally.
That's right. That.
Well, that's amazing work. And congratulations on that result. And thank you for joining us today. This has been fascinating.
Yeah, it was a great time.
Hey, one last question real quick. Matt, when this this case turns into a movie, who do you want to be the actor playing you?
I don't know. Matt Damon would be pretty good. What do you guys think?
I could see Matt Damon, Tobey Maguire. I don't know.
There you go. Tobey Maguire. I'll have to ask my kids what they think. My wife.
Russell Crowe. Yeah. We'll look forward to that one.
Hey, Matt, thanks so much for joining us. And
all right, guys.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.